I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to my colleague, Aline Fumarescu, Associate Professor of Political Science here at the University of Houston. We're discussing his 2019 book, Compromise and the American Founding, The Quest for the People's Two Bodies, from Cambridge University Press. Fumarescu works on the history of political theory with a particular focus on the concept of compromise. He is the author of a previous book on compromise from Cambridge University Press. So, first of all, Aline Fumarescu, let me say welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Thanks for having me.
Aline, I loved the book. I found it to be a sweeping investigation of the nature of our major compromises in American history and an investigation of what compromise means and what its basis is from the Puritans up through the Civil War. So congratulations on the book. Let me start by noting, first of all, that this is your second book on compromise. Maybe you could say a little bit about what your motivation was for writing a second book on compromise and more generally your motivation for writing on compromise in general.
The motivation of writing of compromise was actually really funny. When I was a graduate student, I asked myself who was the first person saying politics is the art of compromise, assuming that I was the only one not knowing this famous saying, the author of the famous saying. So I asked one of my professors, she didn't know, I asked another one, he didn't know, and so on and so forth. And then I realized nobody knows who is the author of the saying politics is the art of compromise. So it started off pretty much out of curiosity. And I started looking back in history, both in French and in English, trying to figure out the author. And all I could find was, it is well known, everyone knows, it is said that politics, but who is the author, it remains a mystery. So by going down in history, I realized at some point that throughout the entire 17th century, the usage of the word compromise in French and in English started to differ considerably. So in French, it was always used with negative connotations, I won't compromise my honor, my virtue, and so forth, while in English, it was presented either as neutral or as a virtue. So I thought there should be some sort of explanation for this, and pretty much the rest is history. Now, about the second book, the idea of the second book, that's another kind of interesting. I realized that by the time I finish one book, I kind of already have the idea for the second book. In the conclusion of the first one, I already mentioned that the American case might offer a unique combinations and the chance of analyzing the two understandings of compromise, which in turn are related with the two understanding of the people, the social contract, the political contract, representation, and so forth. So basically, this book started even before the first one was out of print.
Excellent. And maybe you'll have, a third installment, third volume, taking compromise onto another continent?
No. Compromise nowadays, as a matter of fact.
Okay.
So to analyze, maybe you'll get a chance to talk a little bit later, to get a chance to analyze how the new media kind of transformed the self-representation of the people as political representation as affecting the entire political spectrum.
Yeah, good. Yeah, I want to get there because I find that a really interesting avenue of research, which I think follows from your general way you approach the notion of compromise. So let me just sort of let's just generally talk about your approach to compromise, because as I understand it, I'll just say my general take on how you approach compromise, and you can tell me what's missing or what's wrong in my general statement here. I mean, it strikes me that your work on compromise aims to explain when and why we compromise, essentially by looking at the underlying understanding of the self that compromises. So, for example, I mean, you already alluded to this in your description of the first book, that the main puzzle why, you know, was something like, why is it that in Britain, compromise was so highly prized, but in France, for example, it was something that was, you know, denigrated. It was something immoral. You don't compromise yourself. And indeed, we have that kind of duality here. And you trace that back in an interesting way to, you know, this sort of underlying notion of the self that the British and French have. So, I mean, is that a general, you know, as a sort of general statement about how you think about this question, is that the right way to think about it?
Yeah, I think you captured it very well. Obviously, there are more details about forum interum, forum externum, and whatnot. If you want, I can go in these.
Yeah, why don't you just, could you, you know, like a 30 second to a minute version of the thesis of the first book? Because I think it does kind of, it's helpful for setting the stage for this book that we're talking about.
Sure. So my take in the first book was that initially throughout the entire classic and medieval period, compromise was a neutral term because of the way individuals understood themselves, meaning that it was a dual understanding of the self. You have a forum internum and a forum externum. And by the way, Hobbes later on will talk about them as well. Forum internum, both of them being your true self, so to speak. And it was a very sophisticated dialectic between these two. So in forum internum, I am a unique person, I am completely free, no one can judge me in the forum internum but my own conscience and God. And I am a unique person in God's eyes, right? But on forum externum, myself is defined by the way I'm a member of a community or multiple communities of sorts. I'm a member of a certain parish, village, certain religion, gender, what have you. So one is the forum of uniqueness, the other one is the forum of sameness. I'm alike with everyone else. But complicate things even further. The dialectic between uniqueness and sameness went also not just between forum internum and forum externum, but inside of each of them. I know it sounds a little bit complicated, but if you bear with me. So in forum internum, I am a unique individual indeed, and I'm not my inner self, so to speak. Let's speak in terms of inner self and outer self. Might be easier to understand. So in my inner self, I'm a unique individual, but at the same time, I'm the same with everyone else because we are all created in God's image. On the other hand, if my external self, my forum externum, I am equal with everyone else as member of a group, but this group understood organically makes me different from any other person in that group. So the pinky fulfills, as Augustine said, the pinky fulfills a different role from compared with the eye, but the pinky has no reason of being jealous of the eye, because even if you cannot see as the eye does, the eye neither can do what the pinky does. So that was the general medieval understanding. And this balance allows them not to be afraid of being compromised, because representation involves only one side of you, which was the external self. So I can be represented only qua member of a community of sorts, not myself as a unique individual. I can be represented, put it in modern parlance, as a, I don't know, take your pick, Democrat, Republican, black person, white person, gay person, straight person, but I can cannot be represented as a real fumurist. Therefore, I'm not afraid of compromise, because compromise was a method of election throughout the Middle Ages. Now, things have changed in early modernity, when we witness a split in this understanding of compromise, which I call centripetal individualism and centrifugal individualism. The centripetal individualism was the French version, where only the inner self was remained the only authentic self, and the outer self is considered to be only a costume. As a matter of fact, both Montaigne and Charron use the word costume. It's not a true self. You pretend on the outside, but you remain true to yourself only in the inside. And therefore, I am afraid to compromise, because compromise is always associated with the loss of identity. Now, and that's why all the words come to be associated one way or another with I'm afraid to compromise my honor, my virtue, myself, and so on and so forth, all of them being images of compromising who I really am, my identity. Now, on the other hand, in Great Britain, or in the Great Britain, you have the centripetal individualism, where basically the inner self came to be considered something really dubious. It's precisely because no one has access to it, society has no access to it. You can never know exactly what people think in the darkness of their deeper self. Therefore, what matters was only how you act. Let's think about Hobbes, for example. It really doesn't matter for Hobbes or for the Hobbes sovereign what you think. It's what you act. As long as you act in a certain way, as you are told, you are fine. So the outer self becomes the only important self. And therefore, here the social contract came to be equated with compromise. And Gilbert Burnet, as a matter of fact, used this compromise as contract. And not just him. There are several references throughout the entire 17th century English, where contract and compromise are used as basically the same word.
Yeah, I mean, so that's helpful background for this, because the American approach to compromise is different. I mean, it's in a way a kind of an attempt to synthesize or bring them back together in a certain way. I mean, maybe you could lay out the, I'm not sure if that's the right way to put it, but the way you put it in the book is in terms of the people's two bodies. That's the subtitle of the book, is The Quest for the People's Two Bodies. And so the main character of the American mode of compromising is to compromise with an eye of bringing these two different approaches or two different understandings of the people's self into harmony. Is that right? Maybe sort of expand on sort of how you transition from the first book here to the second with this notion of the people's two bodies.
Okay. So in terms of the toughest nut to crack, so to speak, but crack the code of the American founding and try to find a coherent narrative of the American founding were the Puritans. I have to confess that I spent for sure more than 1 year trying to figure out how to understand the Puritans. Because Puritans are, according to many authors, have spent their entire life studying the Puritans, and here Perry Miller is probably remains the most famous and in my opinion, one of the most good interpreter of the Puritans. Because the Puritans it's very difficult to put them in one box or another. So they appear to be extremely paradoxical. They flee from religious persecution, and yet they were very against persecution. They were very against any other sorts of religions once they founded their own people. They were also in favor of freedom, but also of hierarchy. They also accepted the equality of the individuals, yet also they accepted the hierarchy of the visible saint, and so on and so forth. They pay attention to the afterlife, but they care apparently more about this life, etc., etc. So scholars have struggled for at least more than a century now to try to figure them out. And I think, I kind of cracked the code, because what the Puritans have done way before the social compact theory emerges in Great Britain is that they actually accidentally, I might say, embraced both visions of the people. Because you have this understanding of the people, which is a medieval understanding of the people, as a corporate whole, hierarchically structured, organical, where each individual plays a unique role, therefore the unicity of the individual is acknowledged, but you also have a hierarchy of merits, at least ideally of merit. But on the other hand, they also embrace the equalitarian view of what will become eventually the social contract theory. Because as we all know, they actually did promise to each other to create a new theological political community as Lutz put it, a new people, actually. So they created new people out of the consent of the individuals, which was not a philosophical idea. It was actually people putting their names and signing a paper, and from now on, they will subject themselves to the will of the majority, which obviously later on will ring very well with the social compact theory, not necessarily the Hobbesian one, although we can discuss that as well, but more with the Lockean one. And by the way, Locke was born and raised as a Puritan. So you have this equalitarian, horizontal understanding of the people as equally abstract individuals. But on the other hand, when these people was created, the understanding of the people switched back to the medieval understanding of the people, which was a corporate, again, hierarchical, organized based upon name, which made a lot of scholars to think that the Puritans, after all, were just medievalists, which is partially true. Some people say, oh no, they were extremely modern, which again, it's also true. But the thing is, they were both, because they went with this both understanding of the people. Now, to close the circle about the forum internum and forum externum, what is extremely impressive about the Puritans was the fact that they refused both the French version, like only the inner self is the true authentic self, because they thought that the inner self, it's the one that is putrid, it's affected by the devil, and the only way of purifying it is by bringing your inner self out in public view for everyone to judge, and as the only way of purifying the inner self. They did not go break the British version either, where only the external self was the authentic self, because they said it's only the bark. So the only way of, it's like turning the inside out. And that's interesting, extremely interesting, because they have this, in order to be accepted in the church and therefore as a member of the political community as well, you had to confess not just your sins publicly, but all your struggles to demonstrate that you are among the elected ones. So your most inner thoughts have to be exposed publicly, and then the saint will decide, yeah, you are good, or you still have to wait. Thinking about disclosing, voluntarily disclosing everything into the public, we can make probably later on the connection with Facebook, Instagram, and whatnot.
Yeah, okay, good. I mean, there are a couple moving parts here. I mean, mainly I want to just get clarity on what the relationship among them are. I mean, so you have this, you have the forum internum versus forum externum, and you have this notion of the people's two bodies, and you have the notion of compromise. I guess I'm just trying to get clear on what exactly the relationship is. I mean, just to start with the people's two bodies, is it the case that what's the relationship between the people's two bodies and compromise? Is it the case that, you know, this, the hierarchical organic notion of the people's body is more or less likely to compromise, whereas conceiving of the people in terms of a kind of egalitarian contractual view makes them less likely, more likely to compromise? Or what's the relationship there?
That's a good question, and I tried to answer it in the introduction at some point, because compromise has two components. It has a rational component when you think about, okay, we are making a compromise like a barter, we are trading my interest, your interest, and we kind of negotiate a middle of sorts, which rhymes very well with the social contract theory, where you have abstract individuals caring only about their own personal private interests and so forth. But you also have this more effective component where you can think about compromise. I am sacrificing my interest, my personal interest, or my group interest for the sake of the whole, of the greater good, the political body as a whole, which runs much better with the Republican understanding. Now, what's the connection between this and the two people's bodies? I'm not saying that one is it's more prone to compromise than another. What I'm trying to say is that there are two different types of compromise here. One that plays on the affective side and one that plays on the rational side. And they, I'm using the metaphor that Machiavelli uses when he talks about it is more difficult to conquer the Sultan of Turkey or the King of France. And he says it is much harder to conquer the Sultan of Turkey because you have this organized structure, everyone obey the head, and it's very effective. But once you conquer, so it's hard to conquer, but once you conquer, it's very easy to maintain your control because they are used with following the orders, right? On the other hand, the King of France is much easier to conquer because he depends on all these nobles, which are envious, jealous, and whatnot, you find a traitor, so it's easier to conquer. But it's much more difficult to maintain the control precisely for the same reasons. Now, what's the parallel with the two types of compromise? Well, let's think about it this way. When you think about compromise, about the people, as an organic whole, where every part plays a role and you care about the common good, compromises are much harder to reach. But once they are made, they tend to last for a very long period of time. On the other hand, if you go with the horizontal social contract theory, which is basically a compromise, they are much easier to make, obviously, but they are very difficult to maintain in the long run. Why? Because the majorities will change. And the majorities and the minorities will always change. So the compromises will be very ephemeral, if I may say so. They won't last for too long. So you have two different types of compromises. One, they are hard to reach, but once they are reached, they tend to last for a long period of time. And one, they are easy to make, but they won't last for too long.
Got it. So is it fair to summarize so something like this, that your first book with the forum internum and forum externum stuff was an explanation of why it is that sometimes compromise can be good and bad. And then this book, the conceptual structure is set up to explain not why compromise is perceived as good or bad, but two different types of compromise in order to how people compromise, not whether they do.
That's correct.
Okay.
Very well put. At least the most part of the book is about that, because the last part is also discussing why people fail to compromise sometimes.
Let me,
If I may,
go ahead.
Precisely because the this corporatist understanding of the people makes compromise harder to reach. Once again, once the compromise is reached, it will last, but it's very hard to reach. The uncompromising actors, let me put it this way, political actors, throughout the entire American foundings tend to be the people that embrace more the corporatist vision of the people compared with this more egalitarian, individualistic understanding of the people as a collection of individuals. So let's think who were not willing to compromise. The bad guys and the good guys tend to be mixed in this story. Because whenever we think about the, generally speaking, about the American founding, like a big picture, we think about, you have on the outside good guys, which are the patriots, and then you have the federalists, and then you have the Northerners. And you have the bad guys, which are the loyalists, the anti-federalists, and the Southerners. Now, obviously, this is a very simplified picture, but this is how people tend to think in kind of very simple narratives, right? What I'm trying to say in this book is that the narrative is a little bit more complicated, and if you look at their arguments, the arguments made by initially by the good guys, i.e. by the patriots, which thought about people of each of the colony respective state in their corporal capacity, will be embraced later on by the anti-federalists and the Southerners, which also put accent on the corporatist understanding of the people at state level, while the arguments made by the loyalists, bad guys of the founding, right, meaning that we are all represented virtually, but we are still represented in the British Parliament, and we are just a minority who is not entitled to rebel against the majority of the British subjects, became the arguments of the Federalists and later on of the Northerners.
Right. So is it, so let me see if I got it. So it's the story of our great American struggles is in some way a story about a disagreement over the character of the people, whether, you know, the two combatants on either side in our great American conflicts each represents one account of the people's body over another, right? So is that the right way to think about it? So it's why we have these enduring conflicts and the need for compromise.
It's a little bit kind of exaggerated, but not too much. I mean, it's more a matter of emphasis here, because none of the this understanding of the people's two bodies was so ingrained, and hopefully it still is, so ingrained in the American psyche, if I may say so, the general culture, that it's almost impossible to get entirely rid of one of the two understandings. But the emphasis will switch from one to another depending on the circumstances. And you have to also be aware that because of the unique character, not unique, but the Federalist character of the United States of America, we always have to think about the people at two levels. So we have to think about the people at state level and the American people. The discussion, how many peoples are in America, was a huge debate. And basically, only the Civil War ended up solving this debate. And you can see that in the very fact that the official formula before the Civil War was the United States are, which means the emphasis was on the states, the people of each state. After the Civil War, the official formula, which still is used today, is the United States is. So only after the Civil War, in my opinion, at least, the founding ended only after the Civil War, because only after the Civil War, the question is, you have one American people or many American peoples was finally put to rest.
Yeah, okay, good. Well, I mean, that's helpful. Why don't we get into some of the detail, the particular account you give of the history, because I think some of these issues will come back up again. I mean, the Puritans, you gave a brief account of that view. I mean, the Puritans, in your view, synthesized these two different approaches to the people's new body, two bodies, particularly well, and they had this understanding of the self that's characterized by what you call purged individualism, where the forum internum becomes purged out, you know, these constant confessions of sin and so forth that they had. It's quite an interesting description. Maybe you could maybe connect that up, maybe if you have any examples to sort of make this vivid, how this informed their approach to compromise, or this helps us understand this sort of conceptual backdrop, helps us understand how they compromised or didn't compromise. They're sort of, when you think about Puritans, they're sort of an uncompromising folk, right?
Yeah, actually, that's the title of the chapter.
Right.
Well, here's the thing. They were very much willing to compromise among themselves, but not with the outsiders. So it was a matter, once again, of identity. As long as you share my religious beliefs, my religious identity, they were willing to compromise. And as a matter of fact, it was, the practice was to avoid going to formal trials, the formal system of justice, because since we are bounded by the bond of love, we should not go to courts to solve our disagreements, right? So Winthrop, for example, captures very well this double understanding of the people right from the very beginning, the model of Christian charity, which was written before they actually did arrive in the New World, right? So he starts the entire text with the emphasis on inequality and why diversity is good in the eyes of God. And I won't go through all the details, but it's basically, it helps the poor ones appreciate the help of the wealthy ones. The wealthy ones can do charity and so on and so forth. The idea being that this is how God wants the world to be very diverse, so people realize that they need each other, they complement each other. But he also then emphasized that we are bounded by love, and love, he says, that's something that very few people have noticed. It's two components. He says there is an internal love and an external love. The internal love, he says, the external love, I talk about it in the beginning, which is basically we are different in terms of size, shape, different abilities, but we can help each other, right? It's still love. I have, so the fingers help the ear, the eyes, etc., etc. But there is an internal love that is based upon, he says, similarity. Says like a mother loves his child. It's a very interesting image because she acknowledged her image in the child.
Mm-hmm.
And people, Christians, love each other because they acknowledge the image, the same image of God. We are all children of God as they are, right? So it's, there are two different types of love. One is based upon we are all the same, we are all equally children of God, right? And the other one, which is we love each other because we are different and we are part of the organic whole. So Winthrop captures very well these two double dual understanding of the people, I see.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a little, I mean, it's a little strange in a certain way. I'm just struggling to, I mean, this is a question about Puritan thinking itself, because it's sort of confusing in a way, how they could be so committed to love on the one hand, but yet on the other hand have such a stern, fallen understanding of human, you know, that inside we're all rotten and evil. But yet how could you have an ethic of love that's so pervasive about creatures that are so sinful and evil?
Because according to the Puritan thing, and you are right, I mean, they had a much darker vision about the true human nature after the fall than Hobbes. They even used the word, I think Roger Williams used the image of the bigger fish eating the smaller fish, and whatnot. We are prone to destroy each other. If it wouldn't be for God's mercy, Christ's mercy, and the love of God, which kind of sustains us. So by taking it out. And what is interesting again is that precisely this unwillingness to compromise with any other outsiders, and I'm not talking just about Catholics, but any other form of Protestantism and so forth, makes the things, the fragmentation of the movement very fast, and basically people are still arguing when exactly can you say the Puritanism was over. Some put it like the Restoration, which I don't think is correct. Some people say the beginning of the 1700s. For sure, anyway, by 1740, it was done, the great first Great Awakening. So it didn't last for too long. And why? Precisely because the fragmentation movement, the Puritans, once you say, I have to stick with my dogma, my beliefs, at that point, fragmentation becomes unavoidable. And Roger Williams, it's a great example in this respect. Why? Because he was much more Puritan than the Puritans. He considered himself, so he starts by asking people from the Salem Church, like, you should not be just Puritans, you should be separate. Because maybe I don't have time to go, probably don't have time to go into these details, but the Puritans were not pilgrims, the pilgrims were the separatists. People tend to conflate these two, but anyway. So he said, you have to declare your separation from the Church of England, which is completely corrupt and beyond redemption, now. And people said, no. So he said, then I won't be your preacher. So he left, and eventually he became so disappointed with all the churches that he became, according to his own confession, a seeker of truth. So he was a church of himself.
Mm-hmm.
No one else was good enough to be part of his church but himself.
Right.
So obviously in this case you have a fragmentation that moves pretty fast.
Right. And his love didn't extend very far. Yeah.
What's that?
His love did not extend very far. Then he loved himself. And it's...
Yes. Well, yeah, I mean, I don't think he was very uncompromising with anyone who disagreed with his position. Didn't he love them, on the other hand? That's difficult to say.
Mm-hmm.
Probably not, because in the external, speaking about the two types of love, in the external, he was indeed, and he's famous for his religious toleration, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because he was the one that created the Rhode Island, where kind of eventually Rhode Island, but he was the one that in favor of, you should not persecute people for their religious beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
So he's praised as being like the first guy being in favor of the separation of church of state, which he was. But why? Not because he wanted to maintain the state outside of the control of the church, but he wanted to make the church outside the control of the state, which will corrupt the church.
Mm.
So it's the other way around the story. There are so many interesting stories in the American founding that if you look closer to them, people tend to think one way, but it was the exact opposite. Mm-hmm. It was the other way around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so let's take, I mean, if we had 3 hours to talk about this, we could talk about the Puritans more. But I mean, I wanted to take your thesis up to the American founding. And so maybe you could do that for us and just sort of trace out what happens to this notion of the people's two bodies as we come up to the American founding. If there are any highlights, I mean, I'm thinking in particular when you get to the, you know, the revolutionary period, what happens to this notion of the two bodies and what happens to the notion of compromise?
So kind of like connect the dots here a little bit. Puritanism as a religious movement disappears, as I said, pretty fast. For sure by 1740, probably by 1700, you already, that's not exactly Puritanism what we are talking about. But their understanding of this, your understanding of the people's two bodies, so on the one hand, equally able to create, to vote, to consent, majority consent, a new people, and to elect by vote their leaders and remove by vote their leaders, and yet at the same time acknowledging this organic hierarchical structure of the people, survived throughout the entire American period. And it came very handy for the Patriots. Why? Because it enabled them to be much more flexible in during the imperial debates in their arguments with Great Britain. The arguments of Great Britain were very much based upon a Lockean kind of understanding, right? And they said, okay, you are virtually represented, we are all equals, you are a minority, you have to subject yourself to the minority. The famous, speaking of other kind of things, no taxation without representation. The Patriots realized pretty fast that they have to drop this army. Because what if the British would say, okay, we need your representation, send your people in the choice. They would have been a minority, and second, they were very much afraid they would be corrupted by the British, and because of the distance, they will no longer represent the interests of the colonies. So they dropped this idea. They realized we cannot negotiate with the parliament because we always be a minority. So what they did eventually, they agree with the idea of equality inside of each of the colonies. So they never contested the idea that the legislative of each colony, which eventually will become a state, represents the people of that state, according to the social contract theory. But on the other hand, in anything that's external, all the relationships between the colonies and the colonies with the crown, they said, we are a corporate people. And therefore, when you come to the discussions among the colonies, the corporate identity of each of the colonies allows them, by the way, the Puritans created the first confederations, the Articles of the Confederation of the United Colonies of England, a century before the Articles of the Confederation, which everyone has equal vote. Why? Because as corporations, we are equal. The size of the population and whatnot does not matter. We are equally corporate entities, and therefore we have equal votes, equal sales. So that's among colonies. But when it comes to the relation with Great Britain, they basically ignored entirely the parliament. Eventually, they came to ignore the parliament and claimed that the only relationship is between each of the colony through a political contract, which is demonstrated by the Royal Charter and the King. So it's the political contract outside of the colony and the social contract and legislative representation inside of the colony. And obviously the next step was pretty easy. Once you have the political contract between each colony and the king, when they realize the king will never comply with their demands, they declare the king as being the scapegoat. The king becomes a scapegoat. And as you can see in the Declaration of Independence, the king is blamed, not to the parliament, which actually was much more to blame than the king.
Yeah, so they used the conception of the Patriots, used this conception of the people's body as a corporate body in order to avoid compromise, right? I mean, this is an interesting thing, is that it's...
It was a very good excuse to say our identity as corporate people, as people of this colony, is affected because we are not allowed to express ourselves, to control ourselves and whatnot, and therefore we can no longer compromise.
No.
What people fail to understand when they look at the founding period is that the loyalists were willing to compromise.
Right. Yeah.
The British tried hard. Come on, guys.
Right.
We can find a solution. But once they went over a certain point, they said, there is no return now. That's it. We can no longer compromise.
No, we
tend to... Happened with the anti-federalists, and when the federalists were always willing to compromise among themselves and with the anti-federalists at some point said, no, that's enough. They no longer compromise because it's our corporate identity as state, which is at risk.
Okay, yeah, I'm going to get there in a second. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, we typically do tend to think of this as a sort of the British are the uncompromising ones and the Americans were the Lockean, no taxation without representation, sort of consent theory. But yet you're flipping that on its head, that the British were the sort of Lockean compromisers, and we were the
offering plenty of historical evidence.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
From even Athens, and there is a point that I found about why can't we compromise? We are all British and whatnot. It's absurd to be willing to compromise Britain, obviously, by a British.
Right, right. Yeah, so let.
For example, St. Payne said, no compromise is no longer possible.
Right.
Too much blood has been shed.
Yeah, so let's go up to the Constitution. I mean, you alluded to the Federalists, Anti-Federalists, just sort of bring the People's Two Bodies story to that debate. And so the idea is that the Federalists, you know, expressed the Federalist Papers, they say Hamilton, Madison, and Jay adhered to a the corporatists' hierarchical view of the people, whereas the Anti-Federalists were more on the side of the Lockean horizontal egalitarian view. Is that's the approach? They emphasize the emphasis. I mean, you put it in terms of the emphasis. Is that the right way to think about it, or how, maybe correct it if that?
It's not only a matter of that. First of all, we have to make the distinctions between, for example, Hamilton, Madison, and Jefferson. Well, Jefferson was more on the anti-federalist side. So. They are the opposite. Madison is the one in the middle. Hamilton in the Federalist 15, for example, talks about the fact that the main effect of the Articles of the Confederation was this corporate understanding of the people, thinking about the people in their corporate capacity. Mm-hmm. And he uses capitals for this in the writing, his capitalization. So the corporate understanding of the people is the major problem with the Articles of the Confederation instead of addressing the people as individual. Madison tried to kind of soften the pill and said, no, we have both. We have both the corporate understanding and the individual understanding of the people. So you have nothing to worry about. The state's right will be respected, and so on and so forth. And everyone knows we are both national and federal. We are some structures are national, some are federal. But anyway, it's a mixture between a balance between the two understandings. By national, he understood the American people represented as individuals, and by federal, he understood the corporate. Each state represented in its corporate capacity, which is another fascinating story because the Federalists were actually the Anti-Federalists, and the Anti-Federalists were properly speaking the Federalists, but the Federalists won the PR war here. And the Anti-Federalists were really pissed off. Because a famous Anti-Federalist, he signed all this paper, the Federalist Farmer. And we have a committee, the Federalist Committee in New York, which was basically labeled eventually as the Anti-Federalist.
Right. Yeah, and so maybe sort of then sketch out how then the People's Two Bodies thesis can help us understand better the compromises around the Constitution. I guess everybody knows about the compromises surrounding the Constitution. There are many of them involved in large states, small states, having to do with slavery and so forth and so on. So this is a document that involves compromise. So the chapter that you have on the Constitution is about, you know, sort of trying to understand how it is that these compromises were made via this conception of the People's Two Bodies. So maybe you could just sketch out that story and sort of how this notion of the People's Two Bodies can help us understand that document and its compromises.
If you read the Madison notes on the debates, it's fascinating how the entire thing went. First of all, speaking of compromises made during, now I'm talking about the Philadelphia Convention. We have to keep in mind the fact that these compromises, this series of compromises, which eventually resulted in the Constitution, which was the greatest compromise of all, as Henry Clay claimed, and not only him. I'll come back to that. Was made possible impossible because the debates took place behind closed doors and they were sworn to secrecy. And the building was guarded by armed guards just to make sure that no one kind of peeped what's going on inside. So that's a lesson to be learned in terms of what makes compromises possible and how much transparency can help or damage the willingness to compromise. Now, to come back to your question, it's very two attitudes were at play during the convention. And you also have to understand that the ones that were really against the new constitution left. So most of the people that remained were kind of willing to negotiate anyhow. The two attitudes were, are you going to be led by the people or are you going to lead them? Speaking of the people's two bodies, are you going to follow what the majority of the public opinion wants us to do, or are you going to lead the public opinion where we see it's better and therefore we'll change the course of the public opinion? What people again tend to forget nowadays is that democracy during that time was a bad word. It was like you're an anarchist. And the good word was the aristocracy of men, which was accepted pretty much by everyone, Jefferson included, which is kind of like more on the populist side. But everyone agreed that there is an aristocracy of men. So when the question came, should we follow public opinion, which public opinion opposed a new constitution, as the representative of the states claimed, or should we leave public opinion? Eventually the people that said, we know better than public opinion, we should educate public opinion to see the advantages of the new constitution. And by the way, afterwards, when you have the first parties appearing, the Federalists and the Republicans, someone said, a scholar said, I forgot who said, the Federalists were the last honest politicians, because they acknowledged that, hey, we are better entitled to rule because we know better than the majority what's good for the country and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, so...
Listen, when I think about the Federalist, Anti-Federalist debate, for example, I mean, it strikes me that this is a debate that's not about the basic legitimating principles about government, right? Everybody agrees with Jefferson about the principles that all men are created equal and you form some kind of social contract. What they disagree about, I would say, is that they have different assessments of, well, human nature and how human beings can either, you know, be self-governing, as in sort of Jeffersonian republicanism, or whether they, as you say, need to be, whether you need more of a sort of aristocracy to lead, say, in a sort of John Adams type approach. I mean, I guess what I'm struggling with is why, you know, how the people's two bodies can intersect with that understanding, right? I mean, why do you need to appeal to the people's two bodies? Why can't you just put it in terms of a sort of difference over human nature?
You can, and as a matter of fact, I'm kind of alluding to this difference in the understanding of the human nature during the debates between the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists. But let me put it this way. Without the understanding of the people's two bodies, at the same time, Constitution was made up by a series of compromises everyone knows about, even including the shameful two-thirds compromise. But it was presented eventually as the greatest compromise, and I think that it was fundamentally the greatest compromise was the compromise between the two understandings of the people, which was basically put in right. So it was no longer kind of an unspoken, you can see it at work in the Constitution. Now, to come back to the understanding of the human nature, and by the way, also, the Constitution starts with we the people, without ever defining who the people actually is. And I think that was intentional because everyone can understand whatever they want. They can switch the emphasis from one body to the other body. About the human nature, the anti-federalists, which at the state level embrace the corporatist understanding of the people, were thinking about the compromise as being a contract between each people and the federal government, therefore as a political contract. Pretty much in the same way as the patriots thought about, we have a political contract between the corporate colony and the king. Now it's the corporate state, each state was the federal government. Obviously, when I'm thinking in these terms, I'm becoming suspicious about the people in power, because people in power tend to become corrupted and they will abuse their power. And therefore, I'm asking for a Bill of Rights to make sure that my rights will be protected. On the other hand, the Federalists were much more kind of optimistic. Hamilton at some point says, like, why do you think people are necessarily bad? I'm not saying they are not bad, but they are as good as they are bad. So it all depends. There are gestures of heroism and generosity and whatnot, as many as there are gestures of being selfish and whatever. They understood the people as a collection of individuals that created the United States of America, not coming from each of the states, right? And therefore, when the Federalists, the anti-Federalists came with the idea, oh, but we need the Bill of Rights, which was one of their main problems, the initial reaction was, why would you need the Bill of Rights? Because it is our creation. The federal government is our creation. And therefore, it's like protecting against oneself. It doesn't make any sense. The people, as a collection of individuals, the majority created the government. If we don't like it, we just change it. Therefore, it doesn't make sense. But eventually, the Federalists came to compromise because they realized that if not, the entire project will fall apart.
Yeah, that's good. So, it's just in the interest of time, just to skip ahead. I wanted to bring us up to the last part of your account, at least before the conclusion, which has to do with the compromises in the 19th century leading up to the Civil War. Which I think of this as in a way a three-part story. You know, America begins in an uncompromising state with the Puritans. Then it has a sort of founding period in the Constitution of great compromise, and then has a moment in the Civil War of when compromise again breaks down. And so I thought maybe you could sort of again bring your thesis about the people's two bodies to bear in thinking and helping us with the compromises and lack thereof that of leading up to the Civil War.
What I would like to point out that was the development after the second constitution, right, is that you have the emergence of the first party system and an increase of the electoral franchise as well. The electoral franchise increased roughly after Jefferson election, right? So after 1800, even more so after 1820. Now, with this increase of the electoral franchise, which obviously it's a good thing, it also came with some downsides that people tend to forget. So one of them, that it's kind of overlooked, but it's historically a fact, speaking of the good, is that women and black, the free blacks, were allowed to vote initially in most of the states, I think, but I don't have the numbers exactly, but four or something like that, before 1820. After 1820, they were forbid officially to vote in all states, but three from New England. So, which comes to show that not necessarily the increasing electoral franchise brings benefits for everyone. And why was that? Because with the increasing electoral franchise, you have the increase of populism. Everyone, as a newspaper put it, was fresh from the loin of the on a plantation, you have to say, small cabin. It was a small cabin on the plantation or something like that. Here is something that I'd like to mention a little bit more. The emergence of party and the party spirit. That's something that was of concern for many of the first presidents. Everyone talks about party spirit as a danger, starting with Washington. If you go through all the other ones, like Adams, Madison, Quincy Adams, even Jefferson, talks about the dangers of party spirit. And they made a distinction between party and party spirit. So the idea was that you have, here we come back to the Republican understanding of compromise, the affection. He said, you have to understand that even if you are a party member, you have to compromise for the sake of the greater good, the United States of America, all right? So the United States of America comes first, and therefore we are willing to sacrifice our private, personal, particular, even corporate interest for the sake of this great thing that is called the United States of America. And that's why, and public educators and the greatest politicians talk about compromise intentionally. So it was a programmatic thing to do, praising the Constitution as being the greatest of all compromise, because it showed that people can overcome their particular party interest for the sake of America. Even in the textbooks and whatnot of the time, newspapers and whatnot, everyone talks about the need to sacrifice the party spirit and how dangerous the party spirit is. I have a great quote, but probably don't have time for it. It reaches the
It's evocative, yeah.
And therefore, the series of compromises that kind of characterized the first half of the 19th century were based upon the fact that we have to save the Union. And the problem of slavery was put, unfortunately, in terms of political result. So you have to sacrifice, we don't have to talk about slavery in terms of moral questions, it's a political question. Now, the thing is that it led to the Civil War, was that after the compromise of 1860, which was a kind of different type of compromise already, you have this slave fugitive act, and then Douglas, for example, during the debates with Lincoln, was caught between these two understandings of the people, and he was actually pictured as riding two donkeys at the same time. But on the one hand, he claimed, well, the Northerners should impose the Fugitive Slave Act in return because it's a federal law, and therefore they had to respect the federal law returning the slaves. And on the other hand, he was also committed to states' rights. So you cannot have the two donkeys at the same time in the debates with Lincoln. But what changed, what made possible, basically, the emergence, the success of the Republican Party, and eventually ending up with the Civil War, was changing the public opinion. And it's very interesting if you look how, starting from 1830s, and Clay already talks about the fact that slavery will be solved when public opinion will change. Lincoln says that in 1860. When public opinion will change, slavery, the problem of slavery will be put to rest. Mm. And guess what? It did change. And guess why? Because of Henry Beecher Stowe and his Tom Cabin.
Mm-hmm.
It's like it's amazing how this book managed to flip public opinion against slavery, pretty much like Thomas Paine, Common Sense, flipped public opinion from being against independence to be toward independence.
Yeah. So is this the effective tie? Yeah.
Excuse me.
No, go ahead, finish up.
I was saying, lesson to be learned, never underestimate the power of art.
Yeah, sure.
Generally speaking, to switch, to flip public opinion.
Right, yeah.
It's very practical results in the long run.
Well, and I mean, your thesis is, I think, leads right to that, because if the people, one of the people's bodies, the vertical one, is characterized by these effective ties, as you call it, what better way to influence the effective ties than something like literature, right? So is that, do I have that right, that, I mean, the disagreement, say, between Lincoln and the South, then is a disagreement about two ways of thinking about America and its corporate capacity. Lincoln's view, the Union comes first, the people as a whole comes first, whereas the South, the states come first.
That's absolutely okay. Correct. And Lincoln actually says this is essentially a people's contest.
Right.
He was blamed for saying that slavery is kind of secondary to him, because he said in 1863, I think, he published a piece which he said, if I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I will do it. If I have to free all slaves, I will do it to save the Union. If I have to free some slaves and not others to save the Union, I will do it. So Union came first. But even Frederick Douglass later on acknowledged that he was a political abolitionist. So he understood that unless the Union is preserved, there will be no abolition of slavery. Because if he agreed with the secession, the slaves by themselves in the South would have no chance whatsoever. So in order to save the house, when a house is in fire, first you put the slaves down, and then you care about saving the chairs or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I think you caught the entire picture very well. Lincoln thought about the American people as a, in a very Republican, affectionate type of way.
Mm-hmm.
Not about the people from Virginia or whatnot. Speaking of people from Virginia, that was the reason why General Lee, for example, refused the command of the Northern troops when offered by Lincoln. Because, again, contrary to the general opinion, General Lee, very few people know nowadays, unfortunately, he was against the secession and against slavery, and he freed all his slaves before the emancipation.
Mm-hmm.
But he
mm-hmm.
said, my loyalty, I'm an American because I'm a Virginian,
mm-hmm.
not the other way around. And mm-hmm. Lincoln turned upside down the entire thing, saying, no, you are a Virginian because you are an American. Lincoln's argument being that the state wouldn't have been possible without the Union.
Right.
The Union comes first, states come second.
Well, and on the other side, I mean, this is the of course, the slavery side, which is, I take it relevant for the other account of the people's body, that is the people in their individual capacity and their rights, right? So the South increasingly comes to have a view of the inequality of human beings and not, you know, so there isn't an egalitarian, it's a rejection of that egalitarian conception, whereas Lincoln has a conception of the equality of all human beings. So in other words, I take it your story here of the Civil War and why compromise was impossible is because the North and the South come apart in both of the ways of understanding the nature of the people's two bodies, that they have different conceptions of the people in both of the ways of thinking about the people. Is that do I have that right?
Accepting the principle of the majority, even though my rights will be respect, I will always be crushed by the majority. And that's why, for example, Calhoun came to the concurrent majority, trying to give a veto to the minority, and so on and so forth. So, as a minority, the way you choose how to identify yourself, do you want integration or do you want segregation? Do you want to go with a Republican understanding? Do you want to keep your unicity as a group? Or do you want to blend in, so to speak, and be the same with everyone else? These are tough questions, and there are not easy answers here.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's great. I mean, in the contemporary literature on multiculturalism, there's this question about individual rights versus group rights that beset theorists. So it's interesting to see it taken up so extensively in America. Let's finish up by talking about your conclusion and how you take the story up to the present. Some quite interesting reflections near the end. Let's talk about, you promised, I think, at the beginning, connecting Puritanism to Facebook, which is, I think, one of your great achievements here of the book, that, you know, the Puritan purged individualism, you know, barfing one's inner self up out for everybody to see, very much taken up here on Facebook and, you know, showing oneself for everyone to see and on Facebook. But it occurred to me maybe in some way the disanalogy, though, which is that on Facebook, on the Puritan side, what you purge or what you bring out for everyone to see are your faults. Whereas on Facebook, what you bring out and show for everybody to see are your often made up, you know, amazing virtues, right? So there's at least as much of a disanalogy as an analogy. What do you make of that?
That's a good point. we should have another 3 hours of discussion. it's interesting because let's think about, now I'm making a connection that might sound strange, but I just talked about it recently. It's not in the book, but it's about being ashamed and being shamed. So, if I am ashamed, I'm ashamed because I think I've done something wrong, right? One way or another. If I am shamed, I am afraid of being shamed by other people, right? Think about the history of Adam and Eve. We probably don't have time to go, but it's a really interesting thing. Adam is afraid of being shamed by God, even though he's dressed by them. So it's the exterior that matters. So nowadays, what's going on with Facebook, for example, the Puritans were ashamed. So they felt that, oh, I'm so sinful, I have to confess everything and purify myself. So I was ashamed, not shamed by the other one. The other way around, they said, oh no, tell everything, because then you'll be okay, right? Nowadays, what's happened is the exact opposite. I'm putting everything out, but actually I'm putting only my skin out, the costume, if you want, my forum externum. So it's only the exterior that matters, the appearance that matters. And therefore, I am afraid of being shamed by others. Hence the huge impact and the disturbing impact that bullying has nowadays. Because what is bullying, you should think about it, or creating shame lists. Right? It's pointing fingers. You should be ashamed. But I'm not. So what is good? Normally bullying should not have such an effect. Why? Because if I know what I know, who I am, I don't have a problem being called short guy or whatever, a beer guy or whatever, speaking with an accent. This is how I am. So it's not a problem. I know who I am. I cannot be shamed by others. I can feel ashamed for what I'm doing, but I cannot be shamed by others because I don't care about the exterior. If I care, I care only about the exterior, how I look, how I appear in other people's eyes. Obviously, I'm afraid of being shamed. And therefore, I try to present my best, quote-unquote, self, my best car, my best haircut, spending my vacations in Monte Carlo, even though I'm not doing this, but this is how I... So, to come back to the to wrap things up, because I think we are kind of running out of time here, about why is this lack of compromise? The lack of compromise is no longer something that characterizes only the United States of America. It's something that goes on all around. And therefore, at least in my opinion, it has to be related necessarily, logically, has to be related to a phenomenon that goes on across the entire world, across different cultures, across different understandings of the people, and so on and so forth. And what is that connects everything? The new media. And the new media, I think, comes with the problem of, again, close the circle, self-identification, self-representation. Because I would like to be treated equally with everyone else, right? But at the same time, I want to preserve my uniqueness. How can I preserve my uniqueness? By grabbing one identity, and the smaller the identity, the better, and protect it with, at all costs. So I'm not just, let me put it this way. I, as a wear-glassing guy, I can feel that I'm at disadvantage compared with non, like you,
I just bought glasses yesterday, so I can join your club. Yeah.
Okay. It's not right because Jeff can see. I cannot see as well as Jeff. I'm like a blind hole without my glasses. And I can identify myself with anyone that wears glasses. We are at disadvantage compared with the other people. But then there's not enough because I'm wearing glasses because I have myopia. So people with other forms of white, maybe they are sunglasses. So I'm trying to identify with a smaller group inside the group of the wearing glasses. But now I have also astigmatism. And I have even hypermetropia. So I can identify myself with smaller and smaller and smaller groups, and I'm putting myself in smaller and smaller and smaller boxes. It's like the Russian puppets only going the other way around. We start from the exterior and going willingly towards the smaller, smaller puppet inside in the hope that this is a way of protecting our uniqueness, which I think it's a false move. But
yeah, I mean, do you get the sense that that's the trajectory with the media? I mean, in a way, what seems to be the trajectory is, I guess, what's been familiarly described as a kind of tribalism, which is that you don't sort of get in touch with your uniqueness, but you identify yourself with the big group, and you identify others, you de-individualize others. And associate them with big groups. And so, I mean, this is one of the reasons I'm not on Twitter, because it strikes me this is the character of a lot of that kind of dispute, which is a sort of, aligning with homogeneous identity claims rather than what I think what you're describing, which is a kind of, that might be better if people were trying to search out their own uniqueness. What do you make of that? What do you think?
Well, I think that this group, the reason why we are going to smaller and smaller groups is precisely because we are in search of the uniqueness. Now, obviously, everyone says, oh, I want my authentic self. Okay, that's good. Everyone is in search of his or her authentic self, inner self, what have you. But you cannot be but part of a larger group. So, I think the way we are thinking and managing and talking and describing our identities is what matters. I think the battles of the future will be battles over words and images and how we are using them. What I'm trying to say here is, if you put the emphasis on first and foremost, we are all human beings, then we are first and foremost Americans, and then we are Black Americans, Asian, whites, religious, non-religious, gay, straight, whatever. But what defines us, politically speaking, our first political identity is that we are American. identity is that I'm wearing glasses, or I'm from Virginia, or I'm straight, or whatnot, then that becomes a problem. Like it became from the Southerners for example, right? He says, I'm an American because I'm a Virginian. So I place my local identity before the American identity. What's the result? The Civil War. So it's a matter of how you define yourself. And these are not in stone. These identities are not written in stone. So I can change about the way I'm thinking about myself. Think about Europeans, the case of Europeans, the French and the Germans, right? They hated each other. They fought each other for centuries. Once they started identifying themselves, we are first Europeans, and then we are French and Germans. No one denies that they are French and Germans. But we are first and foremost Europeans. They stopped fighting. So it's pretty simple if you start thinking about it. But if you put your... And what's also important, and I can finish here, but something that I didn't mention and I should have mentioned. What characterizes, what makes the American exception is exceptional is the fact that these people were created from the very beginning as political people, not based upon community of language, tradition, religion, or anything like that. Think about the Puritans that came from New England, spoke English, had the same traditions, the same whatever, but they defined themselves, we are creating ourselves as a new people through political acceptance. And even if we are both Puritans, the people from Massachusetts do not think about themselves as the same as the people from Connecticut, for example. They thought about themselves as different people, despite all of the other similarities. Or think about the Declaration of Independence, where in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands and connect it to another. Consanguinity doesn't matter. The fact that we are all British doesn't matter. We speak the same language, have the same tradition, doesn't matter. The political bands matter.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the Americans should be reminded every now and then that what's great about America is that we are political people. Lincoln, by the way, has a great speech about that. We are all connected because we believe in the same values, not because we are from Russia, from Romania, from white, black, straight, whatever. These are important differences, not to be neglected, but this is not the most important political identity. It should be the American identity.
That's a good place to end. So let me conclude by saying thank you so much, Elian Fumarescu, for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.